Please turn to Genesis 11, chapter 11, where we finished last time. This is the ABC of scattering, part 3. And we're going to go from Shinar, from the Tower of Babel. We're going to go and talk about Abraham again, or Abram for the most part of it, and Lot. Again, we finished last time in verse 9, and again we were going through the Babel account there. The subsequent verses then, after this, they go through 7 or 8 generations of the family of Noah's son Shem. So let's begin there in verse 10 today. Verse 10, these are the generations of Shem. Shem was 100 years old and begat Arphaxad 2 years after the flood. And Shem lived after he begat Arphaxad 500 years and begat sons and daughters. There was lots of more begetting going on there. And then we come in verse 23, we come to the time of the next significant players, without going through all of that begetting there. We come to the time of the next significant players in our series, verse 23. And Serug lived after he begat Nahor, and there was 2 Nahors. There was Nahor the first, Nahor the second, we'll see that. 200 years and begat sons and daughters. And Nahor lived 29 years and begat Terah. And Terah lived 70 years and begat Abram, Nahor the second, and Haran. Now the author ends the genealogy right there, but he repeats this last section perhaps for emphasis, because these folks now we're going to talk about here, especially Abram, and plus one more person, figure greatly in the important events of the next 14 chapters. Verse 27, now these are the generations of Terah. Terah begat Abram, Nahor the second, and Haran, and Haran begat Lot. So, now just to show how far the Shemites had strayed from God's ways over the past years here, many of them, and possibly even including Terah, had become idol worshippers. Many years later, the Lord told the Israelites through Joshua, and you don't have to turn there, this I'll read it to you from you can if you want, Joshua chapter 27 and verse 2, but the Lord through Joshua said, your fathers lived of old beyond the Euphrates. Terah, the father of Abraham and of Nahor, and they served other gods. They served other gods. So again, they'd really strayed away from God's way of life. So not only were they called out of Ur, they were also called out of idolatry. Verse 28, and Haran died before his father Terah in the land of his nativity in Ur of the Chaldees. So by this time, the Babel episode was behind them, and their scattering across the face of the earth had continued, at least to some extent. And here, for the very first time, we read of this place called Ur of the Chaldees, which Genesis says was the land of his nativity. It says there, so we say, whose nativity? Who was he talking about? Whose birth? Who was born in Ur of the Chaldees? Was it Haran or was it Terah? I'm not really sure, it doesn't say, but it may be both. Might be both, but that's okay. The important thing for us to note is that this group of Shemites had come to another halt at this place called Ur of the Chaldees. And if Ur was in fact Terah's birthplace, if you think about it, he was the father, he was the patriarch there, that would mean that they had been living there much longer than if it were only his son Haran who'd been born there. But either way, history seems to have been repeating itself here to some extent. Just like the Shinar or Babel group that we read about last time, maybe these Shemites also thought that, and there's a lot of maybes in here because we don't have all the details, just saying maybe these Shemites also thought that although God, they knew that God wanted them to scatter across the face of the earth, in their minds, logically, it must have been, surely it must have been acceptable to him that various groups would eventually arrive at their final dwelling places. And if so, was this theirs? Was this their final dwelling place at Ur? On the other hand, if this extended halt at Ur of the Chaldees did displease the Lord, then perhaps the death of Haran was another slap on the wrist for failing to learn the lesson of the Shinar and Babel episode. Again, we don't have all the details, so we have so little information, we have to really read what the verses say, and we must dig in. Okay, go down to verse 31, please. Verse 31. And Terah took Abram, his son, and Lot, it says the son of Haran, his son's son, so Lot was Terah's grandson, and Sarai, his daughter-in-law, and his son Abram's wife, and they went forth with them from Ur of the Chaldees to go into the land of Canaan. So we read that, and we ask the question, did Terah just wake up one morning with this thought in his mind, hey gang, let's head down to the land of Canaan, I've heard that it's pretty nice down that way? Well, obviously not. If you think about it, the flood had virtually changed so much of the geography of the earth, and from what we know, there was few, if any, had yet ventured into that area of Canaan, perhaps other than the extended family of Canaan, who we read about last time was the son of Ham. They call it the land of Canaan. So what, or rather who, caused Terah to head back out on the road again and to move his extended family toward the land of Canaan? Please bookmark chapter 11 and just go over just for one verse to chapter 15, please. Chapter 15. And that's part of the answer is right there. Genesis chapter 15 and verse 7. And he, talking about the Lord, Yahweh, said unto him, talking about Abram, I am the Lord that brought you out of Ur of the Chaldees to give you this land to inherit it. Which land? We're not sure exactly where Abram was at that time. It was probably somewhere near Sodom, which is the last geographical mention before that verse. But obviously we know that wherever he was in part of the promised land of Canaan. And if we can just nip over there, and this is recorded many years later by Nehemiah, let's go over to Nehemiah chapter 9, please. Nehemiah chapter 9. Ezra, Nehemiah chapter 9. And again, just one verse here, Nehemiah chapter 9, verse 7. You are the Lord, the God, says Yahweh Elohim, who did choose Abram and brought him forth out of Ur of the Chaldees and gave him the name of Abraham. So, There's the answer right there. It was the Lord God who caused Terah, Abram, and their families to leave Ur. And likely, from what we understand as we go along, and if you think that Terah at some point was an idolater, that it was likely through the influence of Abram, from the Lord through Abram to Terah. And we think that there's a possibility that the Lord had a frown of displeasure on his face at the unauthorized halt at Ur of the Chaldees, but it was he who set them back on the road again towards the land of Canaan and obviously beyond. So the Lord somehow made it evident to them that Ur was not their final destination. When we were still talking about the covenant, the Abrahamic covenant, we went into Ur, we looked at Ur a little bit, and it went from a pretty lowly little town to a very important one at the south end of Mesopotamia. There, it was at that time it was a seaport, very important, very comfortable place to live. But the Lord somehow made it evident to the family that Ur was not their final destination, and that their period of scattering and wandering was not yet over, not by a long way. So let's go back to Genesis 11, please. And we were in verse 31. Let's finish reading verse 31 where we just were. And they came unto Haran, and it was probably, I would think, named after Abram's dead brother, and they dwelt there. And they came unto Haran and dwelt there. What did they do? What did Terah and his group do? They did exactly the same as the Shinar Babel group had done. They did exactly the same as Cain and his family had done centuries earlier. They dwelt there. They dwelt at Haran. And they did not continue. They didn't continue on towards the land of Canaan as they were commanded. So the very same verb for dwelt is used here, the same Hebrew word as was used in the Cain account and the Shinar Babel account. The word is Yashab, Y-A-S-H-A-B. So this Shemite, Terahite group, if you will, intended to abide, remain, to continue, and to stay at Haran, this new halting place. They were there for good, or at least they thought they were. Now it is true that they did stay there, not permanently, but for quite a while. Verse 32, and the days of Terah were 205 years, and Terah died in Haran. So he was only a young fella, died at 205. By our modern standards, 205 is a very long life. But if we compare Terah's lifespan with the majority of his forefathers before him, he actually died very, very young, and actually the youngest of them all. You can compare all of the lifespans there. He was actually the youngest of all of his forefathers up to then, except for his own father, Nahor Senior, who only lived for 148 years. So, we wonder, you know, we have to wonder about these things. Again, we don't have all the details, and I'll say a great big perhaps, similar to Terah's son Haran, and perhaps also similar to his father Nahor. Again, we ask the question, did God perhaps cut Terah's life short too? Again, perhaps as kind of a slap on the wrist and a warning to this Shemite group for making unauthorized lengthy halts. Again, not being dogmatic by any means, just a maybe. Okay, now let's go over into chapter 12, Genesis chapter 12 and verse 1. And this is kind of an interesting verse when you really read what it says here. Now the Lord had said, now look at that word had. Now the Lord had said unto Abram, get you out of your country and from your kindred and from your father's house unto a land that I will show you. Now when you read that, it says, now the Lord had said, and we start to think, well, okay, that was before, that's when they were back in Ur of the Chaldees. Okay, so the translator's insertion of the word had here actually gives a false impression. It gives the impression that this verse takes us out of the time sequence. It takes the narrative back in time. And it gives the false impression that this command from the Lord, came to Abram when he was still living in Ur. Before they'd wandered to Haran. And it gives a false impression that when he says your country and your father's house here, that they both refer to Ur and not Haran. So we read on into verse 4, and verse 4 quickly disproves these erroneous notions. Verse 4, so Abram departed as the Lord had spoken to him, and Lot went with him, and Abram was 75 years old when he departed out of Haran. Right? Haran, not Ur. So this was the second get up and go that happened here. First one for them was from Ur, the second was from Haran. So as we just read in chapter 19 and in Nehemiah there, certainly the word of the Lord definitely did come to Terah's family back at Ur, definitely did, telling them to get up and go. But when this particular word of the Lord came to Abram, he was in Haran, not Ur. This was the second one. Verse 5. And Abram took Sarai his wife, and Lot his brother's son, and all their substance that they had gathered, and the souls that they had gotten in Haran. So when you read in through this quickly, you think they just went in and they just came out again quite quickly afterwards. But this gives us even more evidence that they must have spent more than just a few years in Haran. By the time they left Haran, they'd gathered much substance, it says, and they'd gotten many souls. So the grammar here gives us a clear impression that they had lots of stuff and they had lots of souls, and all of that takes time. Where did they get, for instance, where did they get all of those souls? Had they been begetting again? Quite likely, I would think. And as we all know, it takes some time to bring begotten babies into the world, 9 months at least. And that's only if they were all begotten at the same time, which is very unlikely. And it's always interesting as we go through these things that they had no problem, these Shemites had no problem obeying God's commands about being fruitful and multiplying, but they had big problems with his commands about scattering across the face of the earth. Say, we like that part of it, but don't like that part of it. Now, although Abram certainly would have more in the way of dubious halts in his life, in his nomadic life, at this time at least, he seems to have gotten the point that God wanted him and his family to keep on going forth, to keep on wandering and scattering. still in verse 5. And they went forth to go into the land of Canaan, and into the land of Canaan they came. So the family's next stop then was a brief one, actually, in a couple of places in Canaan. And Canaan is the place where God had told Abraham that one day all of that land would belong to him, or more accurately, to his descendants, but that he was not allowed to stop there permanently. Just like Rick Steves, I don't know whether you watch the Rick Steves programs there, but at the end of his program he says, keep on traveling. And that's what God told Abraham there. Verse 6, and Abraham passed through the land. He passed through the land unto the place of Sychem, unto the plain of Moreh, and the Canaanite was then in the land. Verse 7, and the Lord appeared unto Abraham and said, unto your seed, not you personally, Abraham, unto your seed will I give, future tense, this land. And there he built an altar unto the Lord who appeared unto him. So that if you look at your map, this puts Abraham's group traveling southwards now between Sychem, which we believe was later renamed Shechem, between Shechem then and the plain of Moreh. And this, if you look at that on a later map, if you pinpoint that, it's actually right in the middle of what would later become the western area of the promised land that would eventually belong to the Israelite tribe of Manasseh. So if you think about it, they were in a pretty lush land at that time, so it must have been very tempting for Abraham to call a halt there, to stop, to take it right then. But they obediently went on and they continued southward. Verse 8, and he removed from thence, so they were on the plain of Moreh, he removed from thence unto a mountain on the east of Bethel, and pitched his tents, having Bethel on the west and Hai on the east. And that, I believe, I tried to find it on the map there, and I believe it's north of Jerusalem. Both of those places are north of Jerusalem. And there he built an altar, another altar, unto the Lord, and called upon the name of the Lord. Verse 9, and Abraham journeyed, going on still towards the south, still traveling there. And there was a famine in the land of Canaan, and Abraham went down into Egypt. So that was again, we don't know all of the timing, but it appeared to be a very, very quick journey through the land of Canaan. Came in at the top, went out at the bottom. Verse 10. Abraham went down into Egypt to sojourn there, for the famine was grievous in the land of Canaan. So we read that part of the verse and we say, uh-oh, to sojourn there? Well, actually, so it was not a yashab this time. He wasn't dwelling there, he was sojourning there. Big difference in the word. If you look it up, the word is gur, G-U-W-R, and it's Strong's 1481. Gur, Strong's 1481. And in the King James, it's translated as a stranger, to gather together or to assemble, and the extended Hebrew meanings are to dwell for a time, or to temporarily dwell, and another very interesting one, which is very valid in this case, to seek hospitality, which is basically what they were doing down in Egypt. So temporary stops like this one may have been okay, may have been acceptable to the Lord, especially in an emergency like this famine. But if Abraham and his family tried to stay any longer, then the Lord was certainly having none of that. Again, once again, we're not told the exact timing, but again, if Abram did try to stay longer, that word gur, it has other translations as well. And these other translations of the word gur kick in, because it can also mean to stir up strife and to quarrel. And that's exactly what happened. Again, possibly caused by the Lord. A scrap blew up, and you probably, I don't want to go into all the details of it, but a scrap blew up between Abram and Pharaoh over the woman, over Sarah the beautiful. And the Lord was preserving Sarah's reproductive system for a very special offspring, and nobody else was supposed to touch her. So, verse 20, let's go all the way down to verse 20. I'm trying to concentrate on the travels here. I'm trying to concentrate on the movement of the people and the fact that God wanted, you know, God's will for them to keep on moving. Verse 20, so Pharaoh commanded his men concerning him, and they sent him away with his wife and all that he had. So, in effect, again, you know, God uses human beings to do his work sometime. And here he used Pharaoh, and he used Pharaoh's spokesman here, and he basically told Abraham once again to hit the road, Jack. And so Abraham was on the road again. On into chapter 13 now, please. On into chapter 13. So Abraham went up out of Egypt, he and his wife and all that he had, and Lot with him, into the south. Now, don't be confused, he didn't go south out of Egypt, he went into the south of Canaan. He was actually travelling northwards, it says up out of Egypt, but he came into the southern part of Canaan. And we see that in verse 3. And he went on his journeys from the south, from the south part of Canaan, even to Bethel, unto the place where his tent had been at the beginning, between Bethel and Hai. We just read that a couple of minutes ago in chapter 12 and verse 8. Okay, so here now in verse 4 of Genesis 13, unto the place of the altar which he had made there at the first, and there Abram called on the name of the Lord. And Lot also, which went with Abram, that's important, had flocks and herds and tents. Now, so they continued to be on the move as commanded, but they had not really scattered as commanded. Lot's family group was still attached to Abram's family group. And again, this is a maybe once again, but it appears that God planned and caused what followed in order to correct this. Verse 6. And the land was not able to bear them, that they might dwell together. The word's yashab again. That they might yashab together, for their substance was great, so that they could not yashab together. So as their groups grew, and again, you know, grow larger and larger in their population, familiarity began to breed contempt, as it so commonly does. And we see another example of scattering. And this scattering was intended to be beneficial for them all. We'll go down to verse 9. And here in verse 9, this is Abram talking to his nephew Lot. And I believe that in what he said here, he was being inspired by the Lord. Verse 9. Is not the whole land before you? Separate yourself There's the scattering right there. Separate yourself, I pray you, from me. If you will take to the left hand, then I will go to the right. Or if you depart to the right hand, then I will go to the left. So this was a wise, very wise suggestion for moving apart, for separation, for scattering. Now we know that Lot was a younger man, and we know from what we read throughout the account that he was more selfish than Abram. Abram, who'd been learning to live God's way of give, as we used to call it, God's way of give, was the way that Abram was living, but not Lot. Lot was a pretty selfish guy. And so Lot took advantage of Abram's generosity and his offering, and he, Lot, chose what he thought was the best bit. Verse 10, and Lot lifted up his eyes and beheld all the plain of Jordan, that it was well watered everywhere before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah, even as the garden of the Lord. And we, all you got to do is look on it, go on Google Maps and have a look at a satellite view of where Sodom and Gomorrah used to be, and you'll see how barren it really is. The garden of the Lord, like the land of Egypt, you know, and the land of Egypt through the Nile Valley there is very green. As you come unto Zoar, then Lot chose him all the plain of Jordan, and Lot journeyed east, and they separated themselves the one from the other. So again, more scattering there, more travel, but for, you know, initially, potentially for very good, positive purposes. So the split between Lot and Abram was for good, even though it arose from a negative incident, you know, between the sheep herders and that. But it was based in love. It was based on the way of give, and it was for the mutual benefit of both parties, both groups, Abram's group, Lot's group. And my question is, can we, in God's church, can we apply the same principle to the scattering of God's church today? I'm going to talk more about that as we go along, but I believe that we can, brethren, and I believe that we must. Now as they move along, Abram obviously still cared about Lot and his family and their welfare. Again, even though Lot appears to have been selfish and that they found it necessary to separate, Abram, and we'll go into that in a bit more detail in a minute, Abram went to the rescue when Lot was captured by those five kings, and he also pleaded to the Lord for Lot when the Lord was about to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah. And again, this is another good example for God's people today, that we must continue to have love and respect for our brethren in other Church of God groups other than our own. You know, I hate to use that phrase, our own, because they're not our sheep, as John Reitenbaugh used to say. But we must continue to have love and respect for our brethren despite our separation and despite our differences. And we've got to get away from what we see, the continuous rounds of fault finding and unrighteous judging within the church. Let's move on. Verse 12, Abram dwelled in the land of Canaan. He yashabed in the land of Canaan, and Lot yashabed in the city of the plain, the cities of the plain, sorry, and pitched his tent toward Sodom. So It appears that at this point in time, anyway, Lot and his people were still in tents. They hadn't yet moved into houses as soon as they arrived in the area. And when it says that they dwelled in the cities of the plain, I'll go into that in a minute. But when we go through later verses and later chapters as well, even though Abram dwelled, it says, in the land of Canaan, it appears that he was not stationary within that land, but for the most part he kept moving. A couple of exceptions to that rule, but for the most part he kept moving. Lot, on the other hand, came to a halt. Lot came to a full stop, and he yashabed in the cities of the plain. In the cities of the plain, I think there's about five or six of them: Sodom and Gomorrah, and Little Zoar, and then there were, I think there was another three as well. But it says specifically, says towards Sodom, which means close to Sodom, but not yet in the city. Verse 12 says that he pitched his tent there. And that sounds like a temporary stop. It sounds like a temporary stop. But we later learn, when we get to chapter 19, you don't have to turn there right now, we learn that after he was freed from his captivity with the kings there, which was possibly another punishment for stopping, again, possibly, that Lot and his family lived in a more permanent residence, lived in a house with lockable doors, you know that. And that was in the city, right inside the city of Sodom. And the city of Sodom, from what we can learn by from history and from the scriptures, was evidently more evil and more disreputable than modern San Francisco, New York City, and Las Vegas all rolled into one. Okay, we're still in chapter 13. Let's go back to Abram for a minute. Verse 14. Chapter 13, verse 14. And the Lord said unto Abram, after that Lot was separated from him, lift up now your eyes and look from the place where you are, northward, southward, eastward, and westward, for all the land which you see, to you will I give it, and to your seed forever. And I will make your seed as the dust of the earth, so that if a man can number the dust of the earth, then shall your seed also be numbered. So perhaps at this point, when the Lord talked to him there, Abram was thinking, great, maybe now's the time to settle down. But please notice in what we just read, all of the wills, all of the shalls, and they show that God's promises were all future tense. Verse 17, arise, walk through the land in the length of it and in the breadth of it, for I will, again future tense, I will give it unto you. It's like the Lord was saying to Abram, okay, check it out, Abram. Wander backwards and forwards through it and see what you're going to get. But not yet. Not yet. So did Abram keep moving? Yes, he did. Verse 18. Then Abram removed his tent, and I think, not totally sure, perhaps from the Bethel high area, and he came and he dwelt in the plain of Mamre. He yashabed in the plain of Mamre, which is in Hebron, and built there an altar unto the Lord. looked that up, and there's actually still an area called Mamre. It's a suburb of Hebron, and it's about 23 miles by road south of Jerusalem, and about 18 miles west of the Dead Sea, if you want to look it up on a map. So we ask again, did Abram, because it says Yashab, did Abram intend to stay there permanently? Well, he still was living in his tent, and he didn't build a house there. It says he built an altar there, but he certainly did not build a house there. He was still in a tent. And also, shortly after arriving at the plain of Mamre, Abram had to go away again on another journey. God sent him away on this side trip to rescue his nephew, Lot. And Lot had been kidnapped by an army of five kings. Now, this was quite a trip. Genesis chapter 14, verse 14. Genesis 14, verse 14. Now, when Abram heard that his brother, is actually his nephew, was taken captive, he armed his 318 trained servants who were born in his own house and went in pursuit as far as Dan. Now, just remember where he'd come from. He was in Mamre, which was south of Jerusalem. Okay? So, if this is, we asked the question, was this the same Dan as the scriptures mention later? The same where modern Dan is in Israel's far north, and that's near the modern border with Lebanon. And if so, this truly was far from Mamre. It was about 200 miles, and that must have been quite a trip back then with 300 servants, about 200 miles. Verse 15, and that wasn't it. There was more to the journey than that. And he divided himself against them, he and his servants, by night, and smote them and pursued them unto Hobah, which is on the left hand, which apparently means to the north of Damascus. So now Damascus is another 40 odd miles north of Dan, and Hobah is even further north than that, further north than Damascus. So there's a possibility that the journey from Mamre was about 300 miles, so round trip, 600 miles. So that's like starting off in Victoria, down, for those of you on the internet there, it's on the south end of Vancouver Island, and pursuing them all the way up to Cape Scott on the north end of Vancouver Island, doing what you got to do, and then turning around and coming all the way back again. That was a long way. Anyway, they did it, and then they came back again. Verse 16, because they don't just go and take a guy out. You know, they don't go and take an army out. They say, you're going to have to pay for this. So they say, well, we're going to take everything that we've got from you, and we're going to take that back anyway. So 16, and he brought back all the goods, and also brought again his brother Lot, or his nephew Lot, and his goods, and the women also, and the people. And the king of Sodom went out to meet him at the valley of Shaveh, that is the king's valley, after his return from the defeat of Kedorlaomer and the kings who were with him. So they returned all the way back, and there's a possibility that they came back via Salem, which is verse 18, to the southern part of Canaan again. So all the way back. And what I'm trying to get across here, brethren, is the frequent mentions of Abram's constant travels, even within the land of Canaan. So now let's jump over to chapter 15, Genesis 15. And he said unto him, I am the Lord that brought you out of Ur of the Chaldees. Like he's saying, I brought you all the way down here, over 750 miles, if you look at that, and the way that they came was was probably even longer than 750 miles, to give you this land to inherit it. So again, we ask the question, what land? Where were they? Well, they were possibly right back at Mamre, but they were definitely in the land of Canaan. Because the Lord now gives Abram the approximate coordinates. You know, not in any real detail, but from south to south and north coordinates of what he called this land in verse 18. Verse 18, on the same day, the Lord made a covenant with Abram, saying, to your descendants I have given this land, from the river of Egypt, which is the Nile, to the great river, the river Euphrates. And just as a reminder that Abram was to stay on the move, the Lord specified who would receive this land. And he said, it's to your descendants. And again, you notice the tense there in verse 18. He says, to your descendants I have given this land. Now that's past tense. So it was a done deal. It really was a done deal. And God gave Abram a rock solid guarantee. But it would not be the human Abram who would receive it personally, not in this age, but his descendants would get it. Abraham in the resurrection, in the first resurrection, I'm sure will receive it all and much, much more. Let's go on into chapter 16, please, and we'll just see where we see the wavering of their faith, the faith of Abram and Sarai. Genesis chapter 16, verse 3, then Sarai, Abram's wife, took Hagar, her maid, the Egyptian, and gave her to her husband Abram to be his wife. Notice what it says next. After Abram had dwelt, Yashab, 10 years in the land of Canaan. After Abram had dwelt 10 years in the land of Canaan. Uh-oh. Is this a problem? Had Abram not learned his lesson from the Lord's warnings? Or, again, we don't really know all. We don't have all the detail. Or did this 10 years include Abram's wanderings in and out and to and from the various parts of the land of Canaan? We don't know. But certainly as we read through this, Abram definitely seems to have liked the Hebron area, the Mamre area, and seems to have spent quite a bit of time there. Yes, Abram had been on the move frequently, but certainly not 100% continuously. Yes, he had been wandering, and he had been scattering too. His father's, his brother's, and his nephew's groups had split off from his. And even Hagar and his son Ishmael were actually split off and removed from Abram's group, actually twice. So again, we ask the question, was the Lord upset with Abram for this 10-year Yashab in the land of Canaan? Did it bear any negative fruits? Did the Lord administer another slap on the wrist? Now again, I don't have the authority to speak for the Lord, but just maybe that trial with Hagar, and it was a big trial, not just for Abram, but certainly for Sarai as well, was part of the negative result. Whatever the case, and perhaps because Abram's faith and Sarai's faith needed bolstering, the Lord appeared to Abram again, and here's what he said. Now we're going to chapter 17, please. Genesis 17 and verse 1. I know we're flying through it, but I'm trying to pick on the appropriate scriptures that are talking about this. Genesis chapter 17 and verse 1. And when Abram was 90 years old and nine, the Lord appeared to Abram and said unto him, I am the Almighty God. Walk before me and be you perfect. He said that, I don't know which scripture it was, but he said that before. Walk before me, and he's saying that again here. So it might be a small point, but the Lord did not say, stand before me. He said, walk before me. You know, gotta keep moving, Abraham, or Abram. So, Abram and Sarai did as they were told, and they walked, and they walked, and they walked. They kept on walking, and they walked before the Lord, and they kept walking, and they kept becoming more perfect. They kept growing in grace and knowledge, and of course in faith. I was on this occasion, I don't want to go into all the detail of that, but this is when the Lord changed Abram's name to Abraham and Sarai's name to Sarah. Let's just pause for a minute and let's go back to the beginning again, and let me reiterate, you don't have to turn there, but let me repeat the Lord's original commands, first of all to Adam and Eve. Again, don't have to turn there. Therefore shall a man leave his father and his mother, and shall cleave unto his wife, and they shall be one flesh. He said, be fruitful, multiply, and replenish the earth. And later he said to Noah and Noah's extended family, go forth of the ark, be fruitful, and multiply upon the earth. So Abraham and Sarah now, they did lots of going forth. They did lots of going forth, but try as they might, they couldn't imagine the bringing forth part of it. Poor Sarah was barren, and Sarah's barrenness was for the Lord's own purposes. But he came again, and he bolstered their faith. He bolstered their faith, and he told them that it really would happen. Still in Genesis 17, now verse 2. And look at the tense again. And I will make my covenant between me and you, and will multiply you exceedingly. Verse 4. As for me, behold, my covenant is with you, and you shall be a father of many nations. Neither shall your name any more be called Abram, but your name shall be Abraham, for a father of many nations have I made you. Past tense there. The done deal. Solid guarantee. And I will make you exceedingly fruitful, and I will make nations of you, and kings shall come out of you. Verse 8. And I will give unto you and to your seed after you the land where you are a stranger right now, all the land of Canaan, for an everlasting possession, and I will be their God. I will be their God. And that last phrase, I will be their God, is so important, because this is where we find out, maybe we take it for granted, but the Lord wanted the worship of himself to be inseparable from the people's multiplying and scattering and resettling. And it hadn't been, you know, if Terah, so many of them had turned to idolatry and did all of those things, and if what we know about what happened in Sodom and Gomorrah and all of those things, we know that idolatry was so horrible. And God repeated that there, I will be their God. Okay. Please turn over to chapter 18. Chapter 18. Since the day that the Lord first sent them out on the road, Abraham and Sarai, Abraham and Sarah now, they never owned their own house. So it's a lovely thing to own your own house. But they never owned their own house. You think about it, and they were the equivalent of a king and a queen. They left great riches behind, and they had riches with them, you know, they had flocks and herds and gold and everything else. But they, once they went out on the road, can you imagine getting, you know, maybe, I don't know, maybe 50 years ago anyway, getting Queen Elizabeth and Prince Philip and saying, okay, you get up and you're going to wander around for the rest of your life. Yeah, something to just keep in our minds. Even when the Lord came back to visit them again, once again at Mamre, they were still living in a tent. Genesis chapter 18 and verse 1. Then the Lord appeared to him, to Abram, by the terebinth trees of Mamre, as he was sitting in the tent door in the heat of the day. Now we're going to go a little bit into the Lot's rescue from Sodom and Gomorrah. But due to his love for Abraham, you know, we think that the Lord rescued Lot, but I think it was more for his love for Abraham than it was for Lot, who was selfish and argumentative, as we're going to find out. But the Lord mercifully chased Lot and his family out of Sodom, and he evidently set them on the road too. Let's go across the page, Genesis 19 now, please. Genesis 19 and verse 17. Genesis chapter 19 and verse 17. So it came to pass when they, he's talking about the two angels here, when they had brought them, and this is talking about Lot and his wife and his daughters outside, that he, one of the two angels, said, "Escape for your life. Do not look behind you, nor stay anywhere in the plain. Escape to the mountains, lest you be destroyed." Lest you be destroyed. What did Lot do? He argued with the angels. They'd given him a place of safety in the mountains, and he argued with the angels. After a little while there, the angels reluctantly okayed Lot's alternate location, which was Zoar. And then verse 22, he says, "Hurry," the angel says, "hurry, escape there." And this is interesting. "I cannot do anything until you arrive there." It's interesting that the angel's power was limited. That's interesting. "I cannot do anything until you arrive there." Therefore, the name of the city was called Zoar. Well, that's kind of interesting. Zoar is it means insignificance. It's Strong's 6820, and it means insignificance. And it stems from the verb tsar, T-S-A-A-R, which is Strong's 6819, and that means brought low, little ones, to be small or to grow small, or to be insignificant. And this is perhaps in regard to when Lot was trying to coerce the angels, you know, to let him go to Zoar instead of the mountains. He kept telling them, "It's only a little city. It's only a little city." It could also refer to the limited power. This insignificance could possibly refer to the relatively limited power of the angels, of course, in comparison with God's unlimited power. He said, "I can't do anything until, you know, so and so." Again, just a side point there. But anyway, Lot and his family, and think about it, think about what was happening, think about what they said as you read through it. Lot and his family had evidently developed a very unhealthy preference of city life. Anyway, they went to the city of Zoar, and the Lord kept them safe there. Verse 23, the sun had risen upon the earth when Lot and his family, of course, entered Zoar. Verse 25, and he, the Lord, overthrew those cities and all the plain and all the inhabitants of the cities and that which grew upon the ground. It was all destroyed, all burnt up. And again, you look on, you know, where they believe that Sodom and Gomorrah are to this day, and have a look at the, you know, from once it was probably one of the luscious places on the planet, and see what it's now, a barren, burnt wilderness. What's interesting in that verse 23 is the word inhabitants, and guess what? It's translated from the word yashab, means dwellers of the city. And that got me thinking that maybe if these yashabers, if you will, if these inhabitants of Sodom and Gomorrah had not yashabed there, had not dwelt there, if they had kept moving as commanded by the Lord, you remember, all of these people came out, we believe that all of these people came out of the ark, you know, originally. So if they'd kept moving as commanded by the Lord, they would not have become so dreadfully depraved and sinful. And I think, you know, you think of city life, and, you know, even today, city life can do that to people, you know, without going into all the detail, it can contribute to it. When I talk about city life, I'm talking about the big cities. Imagine living in San Francisco. We know people who live in San Francisco, and it's like, you know, it kind of turns your mind, even being there for a short time. You know, spend some time in Vancouver and you... So anyway, I'm not picking on anybody who happens to live in the city, but you know, better if you don't. After Lot's wife had been turned into a pillar of salt, verse 29, and it came to pass when God, and the word is Elohim here, and it came to pass when God destroyed the cities of the plain, that God remembered Abraham. And then God recaps what he'd just done, and sent Lot out of the midst of the overthrow, when he overthrew the cities in which Lot had dwelt, had yashabed. But what happened? Lot, fickle, selfish Lot, changed his mind. He moved out of Zoar and he relocated. And guess where he relocated to? Verse 30. Then Lot went up out of Zoar and dwelt, yashabed, in the mountains. And his two daughters were with him, for he was afraid to dwell in Zoar. He went to the mountains, exactly the exact place of safety that was originally planned for them, and which Lot had argued so vociferously against and resisted. If they'd gone to the mountains right away, when they were first instructed by the angels, instead of arguing, just maybe, again a big maybe Lot's wife would not have looked back, and maybe she would have survived with her family. The implication is that she looked back, obviously disobediently, number one, but also perhaps longingly towards Sodom and Gomorrah. But did you notice in verses 29 and 30, there's quite a few yashabs in there. And I wonder if they could be significant. So far in the series, it seems that these yashabs so often led to problems. led to slaps on the wrist, some minor, some major, all for the benefit of people who should have been on the road. And this was no exception, as we'll soon see. Now, I have no idea, I'm not sure why Lot was afraid to remain in Zoar. Doesn't say. But perhaps, again, big perhaps, because of his rebellious, argumentative and unappreciative attitude towards the Lord and his mercy, and the Lord rescued him twice, once from the ill-fated Sodom and from the kidnapped by the five kings. Just maybe, as the Lord had done to the Noahites and Abraham, he put some situations or conditions in place which made life in Zoar not as comfortable as Lot's family had hoped or expected. Just maybe, I don't know, but maybe they hoped that little Zoar might have been a little bit similar to Sodom and Gomorrah. Don't know that, doesn't say that, but why did they want to go to another city? Anyway, Lot and his daughters dwelt Yashabd in the mountains. And again, the Genesis account does not tell us how long they stayed in Zoar. It doesn't tell us how long they stayed in the mountains. But if we think back, this is just very, very similar account here, just very similar to Noah's case. It must have been long enough for them to make some wine or to procure some wine. And because of that wine, what happened, a gross sin took place and a great curse fell on Lot's family. And again, this was in some ways reminiscent and even similar to the gross sin and the curse that befell Noah's family, and perhaps for similar reasons. So we're going to leave it there for today. Next time, in part 4, we're going to go back on the road with Abraham and Sarah and their group of happy wanderers. Thank you.